Welcome, everybody, to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 165. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. You just heard James Jones.
Yeah.
Except you probably didn't.
Making some sound. That was Greg Lay there.
Ahoy, hoy, everyone.
And John Lindemann is here.
Oh, nah.
That needs to be edited out because that is obscene.
John's not really here. I just hit the button on my soundboard.
John Lindemann, obscene groan soundboard.
You just pressed the tummy on his Master P doll.
I just pushed the button that says Master P clip 4. All right. A little later in the show, we're going to be joined by Mike Sklin, Striker Obi, for a little bit to talk about Geist. He's not going to be able to stay very long, but he'll be on for just a bit to talk about Geist with us. And, of course, we'll be wrapping up Geist for Retroactive. And the next Retroactive is going to be starting up pretty soon. We were almost ready to start it before we decided to do Geist. So I'm going to have the poll up for the Genesis edition of Geist by the time you hear this. So I'd like to get moving on it pretty quickly. So I hope you'll go to the forums and vote on that, because it should be pretty interesting race. We've had a lot of nominations. I'm excited to put them in there and see what floats to the top. All right, with that out of the way, it's time for new business. Greg is up first.
All right, yeah, I've been playing a whole bunch of different stuff. I've been playing quite a bit of Dead Space on the PS3.
Oh, yeah, you liking it?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. We've talked about it plenty. I don't want to go into it, but I've been enjoying that, and that's taken up quite a bit of my time. Picked Retro Game Challenge back up. And polished off Guardia Quest challenges and unlocked Haggleman 3, which is really different from the other two. It's really quite cool, upgrade system and stuff. So I did all the challenges on that. So I kind of got all the basic challenges out of the way. You're just left with sort of seeing the credits of all the games. So I might get around to that eventually. But I definitely try and play through the ones I really like Star Prince and Haggleman 3, because they're really good. But the main new thing I picked up, so I got Space Invaders Extreme 2, which I don't think is out in America just yet. I think it's a couple of weeks away. But it came out in Europe about a week ago to not very much fanfare. I haven't seen a lot of reviews for it. If most of the reviews you can find online are probably for the Japanese version that came out several months ago when... I talked about it a little bit then because I had a demo up on the Nintendo channel in Japan. But yeah, I've got the game now. It's come out for about the equivalent of $20, which was the first one was $20 in America, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same sort of price as the first one. And my main thoughts on it is it's very, very similar, as you might expect, for a game that was, I think, at one point sort of scheduled to come out of Space Invaders Extreme Remix. The differences are fairly sort of subtle. But some of the major ones are that it does feel a little more smooth and polished on DS this time. It may be a side effect of just exclusively developing it for the DS, rather than the last time it was on PSP as well. The backgrounds seem a little more clean, a little more busy, there's more stuff going on, which kind of makes it more difficult, but you know, it does sort of look better. The action just seems a little bit smoother when there's a lot of stuff going on at the same time. But the biggest difference is now that you have where you had the bonus rounds before, it kind of warped you out of it and you went to this separate dual screen thing. Well, now you don't have that stop-start thing. The second screen kind of just opens up during gameplay, and you essentially have the two things going on at once. You've still got the last formation of invaders on the lower screen while you're dealing with this stuff going on up the top as well. So that gets pretty busy, definitely a test of your ability to kind of focus on two things at once. But I think the other kind of big difference with it is the fact that you can now save when you get play through the levels. Before, if you died at the boss, you went all the way back to the beginning.
Yes.
Now you go back just to the boss. So the kind of the level is something unto itself, and then the boss is something unto itself.
That's good.
Which is, it's forgiving. Although I was kind of hoping that the bosses would therefore maybe be a bit meatier as encounters, now that you could expect people to, you know, have a number of lives to spend on it to try and beat it. But they're not really. I mean, they recycle some of the same ideas from the last one, and... You know, they're no longer or harder in themselves. But still, I think it's kind of welcome overall, because that could be quite crushing when it takes a long time to get to a boss and then you sort of lose two lives in quick succession and you've got to do it all again. So I don't disagree with that decision at all. And then the other thing that they've kind of done is they've added this new kind of wrinkle to the bonus rounds and stuff, which is bingo. Now, so how it works is you've got
going like after the octogenarian crowd.
Yeah, it's a weird one. Like you've
it's a blue
so you've
ocean,
got
baby.
A most so when you're not having a bonus round going on in the top screen, what the top screen shows you is a 3x3 grid. Of squares, which you'll try and sort of make a line of squares in. And how you do that is you shoot particular combinations. Like, you know, if you shoot four of the same, you get a power up. Well, with this, if you shoot four of the same of one thing and then four of the same of another thing, that'll correspond to a square on that grid. And then if you make a line of those squares, you enter the bingo mode, and it's like this orgy of points just washing over you, basically, when you do that. So what it kind of does is it makes you much more aware of the kind of score aspect of the game. You know, it always was there, obviously, the leaderboards and everything in the first game. I'm sure plenty of people could, you know, that really liked it got into that, but with this one now it's just a bit more in your face and it flows a lot more quickly, the whole bonus stuff, so you kind of feel better about sort of actively pursuing it and getting a lot of points. So it kind of thinking more about the scoring, it's almost like it's almost like pinball, you know, making a difficult shot in pinball to activate some crazy multiplier. You know, yeah. Sort of thinking, well, if okay. I can pick off those four blues and then hit four reds after that, which you can be tricky sometimes the way they arrange the formations, and that's where a lot of the strategy comes from, then, you know, I can get a bingo and I'll score some ungodly amount of points. So it's kind of a cool little system, even though it doesn't really change much fundamentally. It does kind of encourage you to play a bit differently and to kind of appreciate what they're doing with the formations of the different colours. So that's a cool little wrinkle, but ultimately it's very much the same thing. So I think if you played the first one and you liked it, but you kind of had your fill, even at $20, this may not be worth it for you.
Are there any new weapons or enemies?
I haven't really seen any so far. I have beaten sort of the easier routes so far. The structure is precisely the same as the first one, so it kind of branches out over five stages. And the ones I've played so far, sort of beating the easier two fifth levels, there's nothing particularly different in that regard.
That's disappointing. I mean, at least a new weapon would have been nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the shield works a little bit differently, but that's about it. I mean, and that's pretty trivial. Like, it's just a big line across the screen rather than a little thing on your ship itself.
Oh, okay.
I haven't tried the multiplayer, which I understand is a bit more significantly different, because that didn't seem that great when I tried it in the original. So that may be right. Better. But other than that, it's much the same thing. I think if you really, really enjoyed the first one like I did, then maybe you'll get into this. I still don't have a paddle controller, which John does.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, baby.
But if you're a big fan, maybe think about it. Otherwise, you might want to hold your fire.
Okay. Now, James, I can't wait to hear about Gra 2.
Nice. You're
sorry.
You're overwhelming with your excitement. I haven't been playing it particularly long. It's one of those games that starts you out with like a half hour tutorial and you're just like, oh my god, make this shit
this
stop.
This is like Ghost Recon Advanced Warfighters 2, right?
Yes. So it literally starts like 2.5 hours after the first game story, which was there was like a coup in Mexico and the president got kidnapped there while he was signing some treaty. It was...
Mm-hmm.
And now it's... I'm sorry, John. It doesn't star any long dead rappers. My apologies.
Hey,
how is Gra really different from stuff like Rainbow Six?
See, I'm not really all that familiar with the Rainbow Six.
They're related series, right?
I think the Gra series is not only does it have a high emphasis on using your squad, but there's a high amount of sort of a technological pursuit that you have to engage in. So you get these toys you can play with to sort of supplement your fighting ability. And you can't obviously just go around and shoot in this game because you'll die badly, actually. Instead, it's sort of... So one of the things that it teaches you to do or tries to in one of the earlier, basically, training missions is they teach you to put your team in one place and then basically use yourself as bait on a trap to have your team gun down the enemies. Mm. So it's little things like putting them in a position to be an effective fighting force.
And are you controlling the entire team yourself?
You can give them directives and you can play with other people online.
Okay. So in online, it would have less of that giving orders,
well,
real-time strategy.
Well, you probably could
strategy.
Give orders. It's just up to them to, you know.
Ignore them.
Yes, essentially, it's up to them to try to go all Rambo and get gunned down. Yes.
Okay.
I'm interested in seeing how it plays online and how the average person online plays the game. But given the game's relative age, I imagine only the hardcore are still going to be out there.
Mm. Yeah, you're gonna get messed up if you try to go online.
Well, I don't mind that.
Game's like 2 years old, isn't it?
I just don't want to go out there and find the 16 people playing online. There are 15 Rambos running around. You know, if I want that, I'll go get some generic first person shooter.
Yeah. All right. Well, I picked up Wii Fit Plus this week, just the you know the disc only version, since I already have the original.
You already have Wii Fit Minus, basically.
Yeah, and which actually it kind of sucks because there's not really anything I can do with the original Wii Fit disc.
Burn it.
You can import your save file though, right?
Oh yeah. Okay, yeah, okay. But the disc itself is now just dead matter on my shelf because, you know, they're not going to take it for trade in without the balance board.
No.
And I obviously need to keep the balance board to play Plus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I can really sell it off or trade it in or give it away to anybody. It's useless by itself.
Coaster.
Yeah, maybe I'll just throw it in the microwave and enjoy my fireworks for 3 seconds.
Give it to the poor, Johnny. I'm just saying.
That's just cruel.
Hey, here's this game you can't play.
The interesting thing about Wii Fit Plus, I think, is that looking at the front of the box, there's an icon up there that says balance board required. And I think maybe this is significant because it may be that Nintendo's finally opening the door to releasing games that require the balance board but don't include it, because Wii Fit Plus is the very first one that does that. I mean, think about all these other fitness games. They have support for the balance board, but they also have modes where you don't need the balance board. And that's because for the past year and a half, Nintendo's had a policy that in order to require the balance board for your Wii game, it has to actually come with the board. And obviously nobody can afford to do that except Nintendo.
That's right.
So you have all these games with really half-baked implementation and whatever. And then you think about, we heard out of TGS that the new Super Monkey Ball, whatever it's called, Step and Roll.
Yeah.
Step and
probably,
Roll, yes.
It sounds like it requires the balance board as well. And so I think maybe Wii Fit Plus has opened the door for more games like this, which actually has me kind of excited. I think there are a lot of games that really could be designed around the board exclusively, but that opportunity hasn't been present before. So maybe finally the balance board is going to become the so-called platform that people kind of talked about it being from quite a ways back. You know, I don't think that was really a valid way to talk about that hardware before now, just because it couldn't really be required by anything. But now that it can, we could actually start to see some really cool stuff with this. And you know, Wii Fit Plus itself, there's not a whole lot to say about it because it's a pretty modest upgrade. I mean, I think the price is right. I think $20 is perfectly reasonable for the content that they've added and all the little refinements that they've made. I would have been happier paying $40 for something that was a lot more upgraded than what Wii Fit Plus is. I mean, I think it's a reasonable value for what it is, but it's so unambitious. It's setting its sights so low. You know, they add some new balance games, a lot of which are pretty fun, actually. Some of them deeper and more enjoyable than you might expect. But they're not anything really major. And, you know, the new yoga stuff, whatever. It didn't really need any of these. And then the other thing is that you can put together routines, or it actually has a lot of, it has like 12 or 16 prepackaged routines of 3 activities each. So you can say, okay, today I want to work on my belly. And it has 3 activities that target your belly already plotted out. It'll tell you it'll take about 8 minutes to go through all of this, and you'll burn about 20 calories or 30 calories or whatever. And it's actually really nice. You know, it transitions from one activity to the next immediately, so there's no going back to the menu and fooling around. It just does it. It feels like a workout. Now, these are all very short workouts because they're only 3 each, but you can actually combine them, so you can add them together and create something, or you can go in and make a custom routine that is exactly what you want, and I haven't even gotten to mess with that yet. It's, you know, it was very much needed. I think one feature that I would really like is to be able to compare my charts and everything to friends online. And I mentioned this to, what's the guy's name? Dave Smith something. He's a producer at Nintendo of America, and he was demoing this game to us at E3 during our booth tour. And you know, I asked him about this at the time. I said, you know, are there any online features? Because I'd like to be able to compare and, you know, maybe send custom workouts and stuff to my family or to other people. And he said, well, you know, no, there's no online. Basically, it's designed that you could just, you know, compare things with your family. And I said, yeah, well, my family lives 2,000 miles away. I'd like to be able to do that with them. But you guys won't take the little bit of extra effort to put that in. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's really sad, because in a year and a half, Nintendo could have blown the door wide open on what Wii Fit can do for you and what you can do with Wii Fit. Yeah. And instead, they've taken this very modest baby step forward. I'm glad they did it. It's a step in the right direction, but it's not very far in the right direction.
Well, it seems like something on any other console, it would be downloadable content.
It would totally. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. This would be a $10, $15 patch add-on, mm-hmm. you know, expansion thing. But as it is, it's Wii. You're not going to do that, so they threw it on a $20 disc.
They're going to make a lot more money that way.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. They're going to make a lot of money on it, period.
But I think it could be a proving ground in terms of, you know, they see how much uptake there is from existing balance board owners, and then if they see that, you know, people are willing to keep spending on new Wii Fit stuff, they might do something more with it down the road.
Yeah. And let's be honest, the only reason Nintendo released this at all is that there's so much competition out there now.
Mm-hmm.
People are buying things like Sports Active and what's her name, Jillian Thomas, or I don't know. Yeah, there's, you know, Ubisoft has My Shape coming out. There's a ton of this stuff now.
Yep.
There's a lot of fitness games. A lot of them, well, actually, all of the other ones don't require the balance board, and people are picking these up without a balance board because they don't need it. And it's cutting into a Nintendo sales.
That's the thing. You have to really hand it to Nintendo because they created a genre.
They totally. And they're geniuses. Yeah,
a market, really, is the key thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely genius.
It's a genre that I never would have thought that I'd really be interested in.
And they've all
in.
Got flat stomachs for it, so.
Yeah, Iwata, that guy ripped.
This is now the third non-DDR exercise game that I've purchased. And, you know, I can't really play DDR in my apartment. The floors are too weak and it pisses off the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
But I can do Wii Fit, and I do. I like to weigh in at the very least. That's the other thing is Wii Fit Plus includes an upgraded channel, which I really like. I love having the Wii Fit channel because I can weigh in the morning without messing with a bunch of discs.
Yeah.
So I keep that on my Wii menu, you know, just right under the disc channel. And I go in there almost every morning to weigh in. And the Plus channel has streamlined that process a little bit where it takes a few fewer clicks and you can kind of get it done in a little bit less time. So it's very nice. But Wii Fit Plus, it's... You know, it's not going to rock your world or anything, but if you've already got Wii Fit, it seems like a pretty sure thing.
Wii Fit Plus, it is the most aptly named game in history.
Yeah, I mean, unless you picked up Wii Fit and played it for a week and then never touched it again, then obviously Plus is not going to, it's not going to pull you back into it, probably. It's not that much different from the original. All right, well, the other thing I've been playing this week, and I mentioned this to the staff a few days ago when I got it, was Guitar Hero Van Halen. I was not expecting to get this.
Have you unbuttoned your shirt to expose your hairy chest yet?
Well, you've been playing it. I've been living it, buddy.
Oh, man. You know, the funny thing is...
Are you wearing tight pants?
Well, the characters, as they're represented in the game, Van Halen, they're actually kind of shown in their modern incarnations.
Oh, no.
What, is it Van Hagar?
No, no.
It's post-Van Hagar, I think.
Yeah, no, it's Diamond Dave, but... But they're all aged up to what they look like currently.
Oh my God! So what? Dave is like bald. Yeah. Have you seen that guy? He looks like he looks like a skeleton, man. That guy's
he does.
Nah, okay, so it's they've been given the benefit of the doubt. I'll put it that way.
Okay.
But I mean,
the benefit of minus 20 years of cocaine.
They're really dressed down. You know, they're wearing very nothing.
Oh,
no,
man.
I mean they're wearing very professional looking clothing. They don't jump around on the stage that much. They look like old musicians.
That's brutal.
Getting a paycheck.
Seriously, I don't want that. I want the jump video. You know, I want California girls.
I was really surprised. And
next they're gonna do, you know, Guitar Hero Kiss where they look like Genesis.
There you go. By the way, John, by rattling off at least two Van Halen songs, you've lost all your street cred. Just wanted to give you that.
Well, let me correct you, James. What is actually a David Lee Roth song? All right, so there you go.
There you go. Now you've actually eradicated the street cred of the entire podcast.
That is
going to
stop all the hip-hop community shunning you, John.
Career over before it even started.
No more happy chats in the supermarket, even if it is in your subconscious.
So,
well, there you go.
But John, actually, I think you'll be very happy to learn that if you play through the career mode, you know, you're kind of opening up Van Halen in this city, Van Halen in this city. It's done the same way in Aerosmith and Metallica Guitar Hero games. Mm-hmm. But as you unlock these different tiers of songs, basically, the very final tier in career mode is Van Halen in the early years. Sweet. And you go in there, all of a sudden, they all have really long hair, and they're wearing late 70s clothing and everything. And it looks more like what you would expect a Van Halen game to look like. It's just weird that you have to play through so much of the career mode to get to that, because that's really what people are expecting, I think. The other thing you might be expecting is to play mostly Van Halen songs, and that's not necessarily the case.
No.
It's about half and half, unfortunately. The case has over 20 rock bands or, you know, artists or whatever. I'm like, is that really what I want when I buy a Van Halen game? Do I want 20 other bands like Judas Priest and Blink 182 and fucking like, what is all this shit doing in this game that has nothing to do with Van Halen? Nothing.
It does. It's in the Van Halen game.
That's, I don't understand that at all.
I think it's just blatant that Activision has the licenses on these games. They haven't bothered to put them in a main series Guitar Hero game for whatever reason, so they dump them in this because there's room.
Yeah.
You know, they can only afford to license roughly 30 Van Halen songs, so they're going to fill up the disc with assorted crap. And most of it is awful, unfortunately. I mean, I think half the Van Halen songs are pretty awful, but everything else is definitely awful. And it's not going to appeal to Van Halen fans. I'm sorry. It's just that there's no connection with most of these songs. The one song, the one non-Van Halen song in the game that I got really excited about when I saw it was Semi-Charmed Life by Third Eye Blind, which was like an anthem of my teenage years, you know, from the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And I still listen to that song. I still love that song. Unfortunately, you know, that song's not the most radio-friendly thing out there. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the version in Guitar Hero Van Halen is like an alternate take. I think it's a live cut from much later in the band's career because the vocals are noticeably different. And at first I thought maybe it's a bad cover version. You know, I mean, it's unusual because Guitar Hero has pretty much gone to all master tracks now.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I like a lot of live bands, and a lot of the bands I listen to dramatically morph their songs. I mean, I love going to see Dylan shows where he plays these songs that you don't even recognize them until the last verse because he's rearranged them so much. And I appreciate all of that, but that's not what's going on here with Semi-Charmed Life. It's just like they're trying to play it the old way and not really succeeding. So that was a letdown for me. And look, Van Halen, I would not have gotten this game if I had to pay for it. But I got it for free because I bought Guitar Hero 5, and they sent it to me really early, which is pretty cool. So I've been playing it, and I'm trying to enjoy it for what it is. I'm trying to play the songs that I think are less bad than the others, and trying to get a few achievements, but that's not happening. So, all right, well, I cannot talk about Van Halen anymore.
Yes.
It's just painful. I'm sorry. So, John, please wrap up with your smorgasbord of gaming.
My smorgasbord, yeah. Well, okay, for a review copy, I got Spyborgs from Capcom.
A Wii game.
Yes,
Spyborgs,
a Wii game.
For the Nintendo Wii.
Mm-hmm.
Got Dirt 2 the other week.
Yeah, so I got a little bit of a review backlog for the first time in a while. Dipped my foot in the deep end of the pool. But
start the clock.
Yeah, I know. Everybody has the clock. All I'm saying is just don't start a hunger strike or anything like that.
Nice.
But so Spyborgs, it's very, very similar to God of War. That's the first thing. I described it to Johnny as a God of War ripoff, but I think that's probably a little bit harsh.
A little bit.
He kind of chastised me on it. And I wouldn't say it's a God of War ripoff because, you know, there's several different elements in there, but you know, it's a straight ahead brawler. You know, you just go through from room to room, kill all the enemies in the room, and there's a bunch of crates that you can open, and that's pretty much it from what I've played so far. I'll definitely be playing more this weekend just because I just haven't had time to really get too deep into it because of Geist and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, so you have three characters to choose from. One's kind of a mix of, you know, brawler kind of range attacks, and then one's a straight brawler, and then the other one's a range attacker, pretty much, from what I've seen. And they all vary in speed. And the thing is, the reason why my reaction to it as cribbing a lot from God of War is just the fact that there's a lot of elements in there that are just so similar to God of War that you just, there's no way they could have gotten them from somewhere else. Like, I mean, right down to the fact where you destroy a crate, like you can upgrade your characters, and to do so, you destroy a crate and red orbs come out and then are drawn to your character. It's, I mean, yeah, straight out of God of War. And, you know, yeah, it's the same kind of thing where you'll start an area and the boss at the area, you'll see at the very start. And there's kind of that foreshadowing effect that they do in God of War a lot, where you'll see the boss and there'll be this kind of like, oh my God, look at that boss sort of thing. And then the boss will stomp away in the background. They do that. And just the feel of the game, a lot of it. There's also, you can do kind of team attacks. And, of course, those team attacks are executed by hopping on top of an enemy and doing kind of pre-scripted motions with the controls straight out of God of War.
And there's a lot of, like, ripping limbs off, right?
There's none of that.
Johnny just canceled his pre-order.
Now, John, are you a God of War fan? Or are you looking forward to God of War 3?
Oh, yeah. I'm a God of War fan.
I am, too.
God of War 2, I didn't get through all of it because it's very similar. But I think with God of War 3, I think they'll up the ante quite a bit. But from what I've seen, Spyborgs, I'm kind of waiting for it to open up. I think I'm hoping that there's more puzzle elements in it because you can actually interact with the environment. And you know, there is a puzzle element to it where items will be hidden. Now, the one thing that I thought was kind of gimmicky, I guess, was there's certain crates that are hidden. Like, you can kind of see, like, their outline.
Don't you point the remote at the screen?
Yeah. There'll be, like, 5 crates on the screen, and one of them will be hidden, so you have to kind of, there's, like, a little pointer on the screen, and you point it at it, and then jerk upwards. It's kind of like, why? It doesn't really add anything. It just seems like it's just kind of tossed in there for no reason.
Just to say that you use the pointer.
Yeah.
Just to get a little bulletin in IGN's review.
Yep.
Uses the Wii pointer.
Yeah, I didn't really get that, but
it sounds like it'd be most fun in co-op, this kind of game, to me.
Well, brawlers usually are.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
That would be a big difference with God of War, which is strictly single player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the one place where it does expand the concept. So what you can do is you choose before each stage, you choose from the 3 characters, whichever ones you want, and then you can switch between them at will. You just press the plus button and you can switch in between. Now, the kind of like one of the things that adds on to which character you choose is you only have a certain amount of these points to spend after each stage, you know, upping your character. You can buy like more health, special attacks, stuff like that. So which one you decide to choose usually depends on which one you happen to upgrade at the last stage. At the end of the last stage, I should say.
Yeah, and of course, it's also markedly different from the other sort of big brawlers on Wii as well. No More Heroes, Mad World, you know, they're all single-player stuff. So
yep,
I guess that's the most unique thing about it.
Can you play 3-player, since there are 3 characters?
No, you can't.
That's odd.
And the other game I've been playing is, for PSP, it was cheap on Amazon, and I'm a big MotorStorm fan. So I picked up MotorStorm Arctic Edge, and it is MotorStorm. And I mean that in a good way. I mean, there's nothing really lacking compared to the PS3 games. I mean, obviously, the graphics engine is obviously scaled down. But, you know, the areas are really well designed and they're wide open and it has full online. So it's really good. I mean, if you're a fan of that series, you're not missing out by getting this on PSP.
John, do you think it's fair to compare or to say that MotorStorm and something like ExciteBots are similar in some ways?
Similar in some ways. MotorStorm is probably, it's not as fantastical. It doesn't try to be as over the top as something like ExciteBots does.
But it's not a simulation either, right?
No.
I mean, it's pretty loose and crazy, right?
Yeah.
It's got a really similar boosted sort of mechanic as well, hasn't it? Where the turbo kind of overheats and you look to try and find some water to cool it down. Or I think it was mud in the first one, but it's water in Pacific Rift. So,
yeah,
you know, very, very similar gameplay mechanic, really.
Yep. I mean, in this one, it's cold water or ice or whatever. I mean, you go through kind of like channels of ice water and you cool down your boost. But yeah, I think it lies kind of in the middle of, you know, a straight racing simulator like a Gran Turismo or something like that. And, you know, ExciteBots, where there are elements where ExciteBots is pretty much always over the top, you know.
Yeah, the terrain doesn't just deform at will.
Exactly. It's probably more like Burnout Paradise than it is like either mm-hmm. like Excitebots or like, you know, a straight racing simulator. But the emphasis is more on getting big air, whereas with Burnout Paradise, it's more creating havoc.
Yeah, I'm thinking about picking up the PS3 game Pacific Rift when I can get a good price on it.
Pacific Rift is really good.
I think I played the demo 3 times in a row, so I must like it.
Looks really good.
Yeah.
I like the feel of it, and I definitely enjoyed the Excite Truck / Excite Bots turbo mechanic. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very good way to do turbo
in a good
game.
I love trying to sort of find those little bits that are going to help you sustain the boost. And also, it's got a lot of different routes and stuff, hasn't it, for a given course. Like, you can find different ways around, I think, from what I've read of the review. So that's
pretty
cool.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that too.
Yeah, that's one of the things that kind of makes the series unique, is that the areas are really large and really wide open, so you can always find different areas. I mean, it doesn't steer you in any particular direction. I mean, as long as you can kind of get to the finish line, you can do whatever you want, however you want to attack it. One of the other things that Arctic Edge has, it has some pretty cool events where you are given a certain time period. You have to like get through 30 gates that are around the course, and you have to, you know, there's like certain like points for like stars that you can get for certain achievements within each level. And so when you get to a gate, you have, I think, 20 seconds in between each gate. And if you can get to the next gate with a certain amount of time left, you get extra points.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Like, so they do mix it up. It's not just straight out, okay, doing the same thing over and over again, doing another track backwards. So it's fun. It's a really good game. The last game I picked up is Demon's Souls. I have not had a chance to try that, but I'll be trying it this weekend. I think I'm going to play online with Nick and Luke.
And that's a PS3 RPG, right?
Yes, PS3 RPG. And from what I've read, it's pretty old school and pretty difficult. And I will tell you that even the character creation screen is difficult because of all the options it has. So it's something where, you know, I'm going to have to sit down and take some time to sink my teeth into it.
That stuff intimidates me. I really dislike popping in a game and having to create a character. That is not what I want to do the first time I turn a game on.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the kind of thing where, and I don't know, if anybody has created a character like on the PS3 in Home, where it has like sliders for like how far you want the character's eyebrows to stick out and how wide you want their forehead to be. That's the kind of stuff that's going on here. So it's not exactly user-friendly.
Said the craziest mental image when you said widening the forehead.
That's in PlayStation Home, man. It's in this game too. So I don't know. I guess
yet another reason to dissuade me from messing with PS3 Home.
If you want to sort of role play as Vince Young, you can do that.
I guess so.
You can replicate his freakishly large forehead.
Yeah. Ouch. Oh, the funny thing in Demon's Souls though is just, you know, from the time I've spent doing it, and I just said, you know, I just don't feel like doing this tonight. It just takes too long, but. The funny thing is, it's like there really doesn't seem to be too much of a range. Like, you can tweak all of these different sliders for your character, but your character just always winds up looking hideous. Like, it's just different, like, ranges or variations of hideous. So, it's pretty funny. Thankfully, you know, I think your character wears a helmet most of the time, so you don't have to look at his hideous visage.
So, yeah, the comparisons with Vince Young just keep growing. Although, he doesn't wear his helmet very much on the bench, which he's been for the last year.
That's true. That's the thing. With this one, I'll actually be playing with the character instead of Vince Young, where I wouldn't really be playing with him. So,
brutal.
I love you, Vince
Young.
That's
new business. Thank you for beating USC in the final.
Yep.
Here we go. It's time for a break, and when we come back, we will be talking about Geist with Mike Sklins. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. Fall's in the air, but there's no need to worry. Nintendo World Report has everything needed to keep you warm. We're like a big sweater of Nintendo goodness.
In our continuing series of great interviews, this week we talked to Anders Bergman, producer of upcoming DSi title Ghostwire, and we also talked to Mike Stemmel and Chris Schmidt of Telltale Games about the resurrection of the Tales of Monkey Island series.
On the review front, Carmine Red gives us his take on the Wii version of Mini Ninjas, a game he considers to be unique and very well executed.
Pedro Hernandez also takes a look at My Sims Agents, a title that he claims anyone from fans of the series to newcomers can enjoy.
And as always, check out www.nintendoworldreport.com for more news, previews, and impressions of your most anticipated games. Nintendo World Report, 10 years of the best Nintendo coverage on the internet. All right, everybody, we are here for Geist Retroactive Part 2, and joining us, just for this one segment, I believe, is Mike Sklens.
Hello.
How you doing, man?
Good, good. It's been a long time.
Yeah, of course, devoted listeners will know Mike was a co-founder of this very podcast, one of the original two hosts, along with Evan Birchfield. And the reason we've asked him to come back, we have him back every few months anyway, but the reason we have him back on this particular occasion is because Mike was a big fan of Geist. He did the review for our website, and he followed it a long time before it came out.
Yeah, I followed that game since the first day it was announced, probably.
Yeah, Mike is probably to Geist as I was to Eternal Darkness, so... He's
yeah,
a good person to have on
here. Your game was a little bit better than mine.
Well, yeah.
No, the Geist isn't terrible, but it's very good, but it's not Eternal Darkness great.
Right, yeah. I think that's been a general sentiment among people on the forums especially, is that it kind of lacks that maybe Nintendo polish a little bit on the surface. But actually, John and James and I were on a couple of weeks ago with Jeff Callis, and we gave some of our general thoughts about the game. So first up... Greg hasn't had a chance to talk about Geist yet, and so I want to hear from him and Mike.
Well, I think the first thing that came out of the discussion that you guys had with Jeff that I found quite interesting was an issue that John brought up. Was actually, what is up with the game's fonts? I mean, has anyone discovered that yet?
Yeah, and the thing is, I said that, and everybody acted like I had like three heads or something, and I was like,
I didn't notice it, and now I've noticed it, and I went, oh, well, fuck.
Yeah. I mean, it's all over the place.
I wish you hadn't said anything, because now I'm noticing it.
And now you can't stop looking at it. Though.
Well, the thing is, I think that kind of contributes to the whole polish thing, right? Like, that to me, really? Well, what are you talking about? You didn't even notice it.
No, I think you're right. And I mean, in the same way, I'm not really a font guy. John, you should go see the movie Helvetica. I think you'll love it.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
It's not about the fonts. It's more than just the fonts here, people. You know, it's like, for example, on the loading screen where it has the guy's head, why does it have, like, you know, like the purple, blue, and green thing in the bottom corner? It just looks goofy, man. I'm sorry.
The little loading thing?
Yeah, I know where that's from. It's from the game, but it just looks goofy on that screen. It just looks out of place.
It does.
I agree a little. I mean, I think where I'm agreeing with you, John, actually, is that I think, you know, what you're saying about the fonts, I think it also applies to a lot of other things. Like, I think the quality of the graphics and the art design is very inconsistent, because some levels are very bland and ugly and, you know, not very memorable at all. And then you get to certain parts of the game are unbelievably beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, still very, very impressive all these years later on this old hardware. And I'm thinking, man, I wish they'd made the rest of the game look this good, because it would be a much better package overall.
Yeah.
And some of that stuff comes pretty late in the game. So, I mean, I got to figure that a lot of people never see it.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I kind of go, as I played through it, and I played through pretty close to the end, I mean, the sort of early part probably of the last level of the game, but I kind of went back and forth on it, because the quality is variable. For sure. I mean, there's definitely some of these issues, like you said, with the polish of the game. But I think the biggest thing that stands out to me is sort of pervading the whole game. It's something that Mike talked about in his review, which is the AI of the enemies.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible.
I'm no first-person shooter aficionado, let me tell you that right now. I mean, I haven't... this is the first first-person shooter, if you even want to call it that, I've played through in single-player since Time Splitters 2.
Wow.
So,
okay.
You know, if the AI is standing out to me as being embarrassing, as being like they're effectively like legged gun turrets, then there is something deeply wrong going on.
What they are, because there's
But thank God, because, I mean, the movie... movement and the turning are so slow, and the aiming is so loose, that it would be impossible if they weren't idiots.
The C-stick is not a device that should ever be used for aiming anything, ever.
There's no doubt that there's a lot of things that go into it, but it's part of a general package in terms of the action, the first-person shooting action boost. It's totally half-baked.
Yeah.
And it's funny, because I don't really think it's that bad, and I'm supposedly the first-person shooter guy.
Yeah, but you like The Conduit, too.
Yeah. I guess that lowers the bar.
You just love everything. Give John a gun and he's happy.
FPS for John is like pizza. There is no bad FPS, apparently.
Here's a really good example. I don't even think John could argue if he's made it this far. There's a scene where you're training for the assassination missions, and you're in this office building, and you're basically tasked with getting through like two floors of the office building without losing your host. And in that whole section, there's guards standing around behind the corners. Not a single one of them makes any effort to turn a corner and shoot you, even when they know you're there. Yep, they just stand there and let you slowly inch out the corner until you can shoot them with your highly inconsistent gun.
Mm-hmm. Right, and when you shoot them, they don't run away. They don't come after you. They don't even step to the side where you can't see them anymore. They stand there until you've shot them to death.
Yeah, and when you've got infinite ammo, which I don't disagree with per se, that decision.
I think that was a good choice.
I think it's a good choice, but when you've got infinite ammo and abundant health packs to pluck off the wall, you can pretty much just stand there and brute force it a lot of the time. Not exclusively, but a lot of the time.
That was probably the only stage you couldn't, but it didn't matter because they wouldn't come after you when you were halfway through the
corner. They were still so exploitable, it didn't really matter. And that level that you mentioned that with the training and everything, it was obviously is like the most extended FPS part of the game.
And it's the worst part of the game, in my opinion.
I think it is. I think it may be a kind of relic, that level of what the game... You know, Jeff talked about this in the discussion a couple of weeks ago, of the time when the game was going to be pretty much exclusively a first-person shooter before Miyamoto apparently sort of dropped in the possession part being a really significant part of the game. And to me, looking at it with all the, you know, the sort of virtual reality environments and the all the sort of FBI agents and the dark sunglasses and all that, it seems to me that perhaps the original concept for the game is basically Agent Smith the game. It was like, okay, you're going
to
jump.
It was probably closer to something like Second Sight when it first started out.
Oh, that's by Free Radical, isn't it?
Second Sight is very interesting.
Yeah.
Second Sight's a different game, though.
It's a different game, but I remember I reviewed that, too, and no one really talked about it, but I thought it was really, really solid and had a lot of great ideas.
Got one very, very complimentary review in a British publication, but that's about all I ever heard about it, aside from...
Yeah, I mean, Mike, you're brilliant for bringing up Second Sight. I think it has a lot in common with Geist, and not that the two games play the same way, but in how they're kind of giving a twist on the traditional shooter formula and having you approach these shooting big showcase pieces, big arenas full of enemies, and how you go in there and you approach it from a completely different way than you would in any other game because of these special abilities that your character has.
Yeah, it takes the whole genre and sort of puts a spin on it. And then especially with Geist has a lot of those puzzle elements where I thought those were really the best part of the game.
I think Geist is a better game when you're not inside of a body.
Yeah, definitely.
I really do. When you're not running around shooting stuff, it never really quite feels good or right when you're holding a gun, aiming at dudes, peeking around corners. When you're in the ghost form and you're exploring and you're trying to figure out, how do I get this host through that door to get over here to scare this other host and so I can possess him, that stuff is really brilliant.
See, I think where this game missed a massive opportunity, and it's funny because they talk about this, is that they could have done much more stealth stuff or trying to blend in through the theft of hosts and getting through without fighting. And in fact, they almost talk about that was part of the whole reason they did the spectral operatives, so they could take over bodies and get around without fighting.
And in some cases, you can do that, actually. Yeah, but sometimes it's sort of optional. It's not obvious where you have those opportunities, but if you really get into the feeling of the game and, like, you know, what your character can really do and, you know, what the other characters know and don't know, sometimes you can really sail through a part of the game just by putting your gun away.
They could have done so much more with it. I mean, they could have almost made it an entire different way of playing the game. And I think that would have been really cool because then it'd be, okay, what body do I need to get through here without having to fight anybody?
Right. And as it is, it's mostly very linear in terms of which host you should be in at any given
time.
It's
entirely linear, except for maybe like one section where there's a few hosts lying around, but really there is one you're supposed to be in, even though you have access to a few of them.
Well, I have to say, the part of the game that really impressed me the most, I think, in terms of making really strategic, thoughtful use of the possession mechanic, is the place where the helicopter's trying to take off, I think, and you have to climb up to the towers and disable all the anti-air missile batteries. And at the base of each one of these towers are all these gun turrets and soldiers standing there. And you play most of the stage as the ghost. It's really a question of, like, doing things in the right order, because you move so fast that the enemies can't really react to what's going on. So it ends up being that you want to possess turrets in a certain order because they can see other turrets, so you can shoot out one turret with another, and then jump into another turret and shoot all the soldiers. And then basically you make it so that your guy with the mine layer gun can get in there without getting shot up too much.
Yeah, and what you want to do is you want to pick the turret that's got an explosive barrel or whatever underneath it.
Yeah.
So once you've killed all the other ones, you shoot that, and then you destroy everything.
The thing is, that's fun, but there's, like, what is it, four towers of that?
Yeah, it's too repetitive.
a little bit.
The fourth time, it's just, all right, now I have to go back and get my body again. I got to walk him up there, ride the slow-ass elevator. and then that whole scene is for naught in the end, which
yeah, that's disappointing. But
it's like, well, I did a whole lot.
Well, you know, a couple weeks ago, I told Jeff Callis that the game feels, to me, more like a point-and-click adventure game than it does a first-person adventure like Metroid Prime.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he seemed to acknowledge that a little bit, and then I think just to prove it, I had my friend Kevin come over and play Geist with me for a little bit. And, you know, Kevin he's really into point-and-click adventures. He did a show with us one time about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kevin is... I mean, he's played Metroid Prime 1 and 3, I think, but he's not really into shooters that much. You know, he told me that he had a lot of difficulty with Metroid Prime. But he came over to Geist. Now, I'm controlling it, but he's sitting there watching me, and he's figuring out the puzzles. He's observing. He knows exactly what's going on. He's suggesting things that actually work. He picked it up just like that, and I think it's exactly because of that. I think it is set up. It's arranged like a point and click, and he understood it immediately.
Yeah, it's much more. It shares a lot more in common with a game like Zelda or Metroid Prime than it does with Halo or anything else like that.
Yeah, but I think more than that, it shares more with like Secret of Monkey Island or King's Quest.
Yeah, it's all about finding the right object and using it properly.
I think in some cases, actually, when one particular case is actually a bit too close to a point and click adventure, because one thing I find kind of irksome playing it when you're in these situations where you know you're trying to solve a puzzle and you've got to, you know, identify objects that you've got to try and use, it's very slow because you've got to kind of effectively prod everything with your eyes to see if you can interact with it. And obviously when you're steering a cursor around with an analog stick, it takes ages just to see what you can interact with before you could actually start.
Yes, especially since you have to find them first and press A to...
Yeah, you gotta wonder what this game would be like if it was put out like 3 years later on the Wii as opposed to on the GameCube.
On the Wii, because the interface is so much more instant. Yeah. I mean, the thing that makes it even worse, I think, is that you know the way the cursor kind of has to change to an eye to show that it's something like that. That process is actually quite slow.
So
you can't really pass the cursor over it very quickly, because then you won't really know whether you miss something. So you've got to do very deliberately, and this will end up taking several minutes to identify. You go in a room with a bunch of shelves with a bunch of stuff on the walls. You'll be there for several minutes just looking at what you can do. I mean, that's just
the kitchen.
Yeah, the kitchen's a great example. That is just poor, and you're not thinking about the fact, well, this is an analog stick. This is, you know, it can't work the same as a point and click adventure. We've got to streamline it. I mean, for instance, Ghost Trick that we talked to Matt Walker last week about, that I think he said in his impressions does highlight what items can be interacted with.
And
so
does Metroid Prime, you know, with the scan
visor.
Yeah,
all it really needs is some sort of Ghost Vision scan visor kind of knockoff.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's almost there with the auras for the people and stuff already.
Yeah.
In terms of the aesthetic, you've got that in place. All you've got to do is just put it in the gameplay, but for whatever reason, they chose to stick to a more sort of classic point and click style.
Or just make things highlight when you roll over them, really.
Or even if they don't want to be that obvious about it, I mean, they could just do what all animation has done throughout history when they want to attract your attention to it and make it brighter than everything else.
Yeah.
Or more detailed than
everything
else.
Well, James, that's more of an artifact of the animation techniques. If you're thinking about Disney stuff.
They still do it, though. They still, things that you want someone's attention to be drawn to are more detailed or more colorful than other objects.
Or in the case of the Avatar movie, it could just be the only thing that's in focus. Okay. So, Mike, I kind of would like to hear a little more from you in terms of your memories. Did you read
I didn't. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to replay the game, but I did reread my review, and it really jogged my memory. And I wanted to talk specifically about the touch that Miyamoto put into it, because I remember when I was talking to the developers at one of the E3s, they were talking about how, you know, that little guy in the corner of the screen, or dog, or it always shows you what you're possessing in the corner of the screen.
Yeah,
that's Miyamoto. Like, he said, you know, you should do this, and they were like, oh, okay, well, if you say it, I guess we have to.
I think that's totally superfluous.
It is, yes.
They seem to be very enamored with it, but then again, they were hearing it from maybe the greatest designer of all time.
You get to see that wireframe guy run all awkwardly whenever you possess
them. Yeah, that is a little odd.
Yeah, I often wondered exactly what their point was with that, like what they were trying to get across. Like,
I remember them saying something about like they didn't want you to forget what you were controlling. Like anyone actually would, I don't know, well, but they didn't want you to forget.
If the rest of the interface is doing its job, they
should. Aside from
need
the big dog nose in front of you, right in the
that's a crutch.
The whiskers.
Wait, I think I'm a human. I have a rat.
No, I mean, to
me.
Be fair, they do quite a good job with the whole sort of altered perception stuff in a lot of cases.
Really, but I really liked how when like when you first pop into a human, like the first thing you do is like your hands stick out in front of you, like, oh, I'm in this new body, and that is a really, really cool touch.
I love being the rat towards the end of the game when you're near all the mouse traps with the cheese, and you still get this cloudy shit over the screen, and all of a sudden you have to fight the controller to keep from running into a mouse trap.
Magnetically attracted to the cheese.
I thought that was fantastic, you know, and that's something, it's like 80% into the game before you see that. It's like, what a great touch.
There's lots of like amusing things of various kinds, you know, like some of the different scares, like the cat
the scares
that comes
really,
out of the screen.
The scares are pretty cool. I enjoyed those.
I mean, there's loads of little amusing touches with that. I mean, the only disappointment I had with the altered perception stuff was the bat. I mean, when it was possessing the bat, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be like the Metroid Prime 2 Echo Visor kind of thing, you know, the sonar.
Yeah. Yep.
It's pretty much just like every other animal.
That's a shame. That really is a shame.
But, I mean, how can you talk about the game without talking about the part where you get to possess Showerhead and look at, you know, naked women?
Oh, yeah.
That part of the game was... I was just like, oh my god, really? Are we really doing
this?
I'm just like, now this is a first-person shooter. What?
Looking down the barrel of the gun, baby.
Okay, so there is a lot of stuff to possess, but I do feel like towards maybe in the second half of the game, it seems like the creative ideas about what you can and possess and how you scare people, they start to run out a little bit. It's more about doing some of the stuff you did earlier, but maybe in a slightly different way.
Well, and later in the game, they do less scares. I mean, they just aren't there. I mean,
it's true.
Early in the game, you're jumping from one thing to the next, but late in the game, they're kind of like, all right, here's your generic soldier you're going to run for the majority of this level.
Yeah.
And then
there is the one level where you're just the ghost, and I loved that level.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a change of pace from everything else, but I thought it was really well done, very atmospheric, little straight-up puzzle solving, you know, just to remind you.
And we kind of touched on that level last week, where that was the big story reveal portion of the game.
Mm-hmm.
But then it went back to where it was earlier.
Not long after that is when you get the whole action level, right?
Yeah.
I think it's the exact next
level.
Yeah, it goes all the sort of the complete other way after that.
All right, now you're going to be a sniper who has to snipe 30 people without leaving the same position. Yeah. Well, first off, your enemy must be stupid as hell to just let you snipe them.
Yeah.
And two, you must be stupid as hell to just stand there and keep doing it.
Actually, you know, the virtual reality training level.
That's cool.
There, about 3/4 of the way through the game. I actually like it. I think there, like many other things in Geist, there's some execution problems with it. But I love the idea that, you know, this totally would have been the final level in any other first-person shooter. Invading an embassy, killing all these secret agents, trying to kidnap an ambassador. Like, that's, you know, very stereotypical first-person shooter stuff. And in Geist, they take you through this weird training thing where they kind of give you a taste of these different elements without making you play through the whole mission. But then, of course, at the end, once again, the virtual reality thing breaks down and you end up never having to do that. Like, and that basically what they're showing you is this is what you're trying to prevent. I thought it, you know, in a narrative sense, I thought it was really brilliant and a nice little subversion of what you would expect in, you know, a typical first-person shooter. I mean, that level was the conduit, basically. It was, you know, going through a government building and shooting a bunch of dudes.
But it was everything we make fun of about the conduit, though.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it wasn't the parts of the conduit that showed some kind of execution. It was the parts that were like, well, this is generic.
It was the goofy generic stuff, and I think Geist is almost making fun of that stuff a little bit.
I don't know. That level didn't feel very tongue-in-cheek, considering how if you made the most... Guy gets out the door, oh, you're fucked now. It's, yeah. It's like, I just killed 30 soldiers. One dude makes it out the door, it's all over, huh? Really?
Yeah, and I think it may well have been a sort of narratively elegant way of working in a level that was, you know, from a sort of previous version of the game,
probably.
Essentially. Salvaging something from that era of the game's development. I certainly prefer that to what I think is the absolute nadir of the game, which is throwing dog biscuits in front of the dog. That is terrible.
That was awful.
That is preposterously bad. I have no idea how that could possibly make its way to a final product that has, you know, some really quite good things about it. It's mind-blowing.
Right.
It's because it's so slow. It's so painfully slow. It's like, oh yeah, it was back that way. Alright, here we go again. Start throwing the biscuits at his.
Well, and the other thing is, you're not really sure where you're supposed to be going, so you almost have to explore with the dog on the leash. Oh, it's really... You're right, man. It's awful.
Abysmal.
We need to take a mini break here to let Mike go. He can't stick around. But we're gonna talk a little bit more about Geist after that. We got some comments from the forums I want to read and maybe kind of get some final thoughts on it. So first we have to say bye to Mike. Sorry you couldn't stay longer.
Sorry, man. Guys. I hate to podcast and run.
It's okay. You'll make it up to us.
I will.
With favors.
There will be favors. I'm doing air quotes. Favors. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah, Florida State football tickets, right?
Do you want those?
I don't As if I would want those. No, that was sarcastic. All right, man. Well, thanks for coming and doing this.
Glad to be
and
back.
Next time we'll have you on for a little longer, okay?
Hopefully.
All right. Thanks, man.
Bye, guys.
Okay, well, now that Mike's gone, we're going to wrap up the Geist thing with some forum posts here. And the first one comes from, I guess this is pronounced E-Jamer. Probably not, but... I'm going to say E-Jamer, and he posted,
perfect.
My initial impressions are that Geist has great ideas, but also some problems in implementation. We've said as much, for sure. Over time, I've gotten more used to jumping in and out of bodies to help with combat, first by scouting out an area to see what's ahead, and later taking advantage of inanimate objects like grenades, explosive boxes, and gun turrets during
easy
combat moments. So, wrapping up E-Jamer's post here, or what I clipped out of it, I'm hoping the game will find more reasons to spend time in your incorporeal form as it continues and place less and less focus on normal FPS action. So far, it really hasn't lived up to its potential, but has offered flashes of brilliance.
That's basically what we said earlier.
Well, I guess the point to make there is it kind of goes a bit bipolar at the end, really.
Yeah.
Isn't it? You know, like, it starts to emphasize one or the other, rather than kind of synthesizing the two.
Yeah, not a lot of synergy here in gameplay types.
No, and I definitely think, you know, the sort of the real point-and-click adventure level in the mansion is definitely much more preferable. And it looks a lot better as well. I mean, sort of the lighting and the texture detail and everything is by far the most impressive.
I love that environment. I mean, the puzzle itself was pretty standard stuff, but
it was well
done. And
there was the bit where you played a rhythm game with a horse.
Oh yeah, I don't know. No comment. But there, you know,
day-to-day
one interesting thing about that chapter is that there's actually some kind of light platforming where you're floating from one, you know, you're floating across gaps and stuff like that. And
yeah,
and at one point you even kind of float over a wall.
I hate that. Like, I hated that. For whatever reason, it would hit something and they couldn't see. And
there's some collision detection issues, I think, there and elsewhere. I mean, at one point, I was quite concerned because I'd been, you know, quite far into a level or whatever since I'd last would have saved at a checkpoint, and I was stuck in, like, I think it was one of the computer-y kind of areas, and I was like stuck on a chair and I couldn't move.
I thought
I was completely doomed, but then I found something I could possess by remote. It was one object within view that I could possess, which got me out of that jam. Otherwise, I would have had to lose all my progress.
I did actually get stuck at one point. There's an elevator that you have to shoot out the cables on.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And I was in ghost form and went over that ledge. And it's too high to float out of, so you're just stuck there.
There's a menu option to restart level.
Yeah, that's what you have to do.
Oh, yeah, but that's the point. You lose your, you know...
And you have to go back and do that whole scene where you fought all those guys in that room. Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, it was a very frustrating experience, let's put it that way. Because I thought, but the puzzle, it makes sense, that you'd be able to go from one area into the other area you can see through the elevator shaft, but you can't. So don't try it.
Yeah, you can just get that kind of feel going through some of the areas that you're just like, you know what? I bet you they didn't really think this through very well. Exactly, in terms of what you can do versus what the way the level is structured.
I think some of the problems are that you can go back to what Jeff was talking about in the interview that we did with him, that they did change a lot of the conceptual basis of the game. And the some of these sort of undercooked and sort of rough around the edges kind of elements really does sort of betray that, and the fact that eventually they had to say, look, we've got to put something out, mm-hmm. and this is it, and unfortunately in some areas that really shows.
I think more than the development shifting and time crunches and stuff, really they had a lot of time to make this game. It was a pretty long development process, 3-4 years, and I think, not to rag on InSpace, but I think a lot of the problems in the game kind of look like the developer was inexperienced, especially with making a game of this scope, with this kind of production quality, this high concept, where this many things could go wrong. And, the game certainly turned out quite well overall, I would say, but a lot of these inconsistencies we've brought up and some of the kind of strangely oddly balanced or imbalanced boss battles and, weird sequences and maybe some pacing problems at times. A lot of this to me feels like, this is kind of the first time they'd made a game even remotely this grandiose. And unfortunately, it's the last time that they've done that.
Yeah.
I would really love to see them take another crack at it because, I'm sure they learned a ton doing this.
Well, maybe they did, but how many of the people who learned those lessons are still there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the newest console game they made is they did the Wii version of Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2.
Yeah.
And the reviews were really bad on that.
Oh, yeah. It's a massively inferior version.
Maybe you're right that a lot of the talent has left in space. I don't know.
I mean, I can just see that being one of those development houses that has a lot of turnover.
It could be. I mean, they do a lot of licensed stuff. Well, Gearbox Clock posted, the puzzles make sense, although some of the layout could have been more intuitive. The possessions of non-humans are enjoyable, and the fact that some of the earlier sections allow for a semi-stealthy approach, such as pretending to be an enemy, is very enjoyable. This is something we talked about with Mike a little bit, but I really like the stealth aspect of the game, and a lot of times it is very optional. But I think if you take advantage of it, it's actually one of the more fun parts of the game, and I wish they had leveraged that a little bit more, actually.
Yeah, I that's what James said, and I agree with that too, because clearly, just some of it is because of how ineffective the sort of outright action is.
Yeah.
You'd prefer to solve it another way, but it's not just in that sort of negative contrast sense. I just think it would have worked well on its own merits.
And it would have made the game more unique, too.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of like the empowerment of being able to fly around as a ghost and kind of take account of the situation, even in the middle of combat. I like how you can look around and see what all is going on. And, you're invisible, so the enemies can't shoot at you. I mean, it gives you kind of an interesting perspective on what's going on.
Yeah, you can almost take a time out if you want.
Right, but not completely.
You could do things like, sort of advance scout a room, basically, with the ghost. So you could say, all right, enemies are going to be here, here, here. So when you go in firing, you're going to be able to take them out pretty expediently.
And that makes the fact they don't move even more ridiculous.
Yes.
Because you know where they are.
You have marked down precisely where they will be. You can be very sure of that.
Right. In fact, you can just start firing because you know you're going to connect before you even turn that corner.
I mean, one of the cool bits, I think, it was kind of empowering as a ghost. One of the most effective bits that kind of blended the two sort of parts was the motorcycle chase scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Once I figured out how to do it, that was a fun scene.
It was a cool idea for a set piece in general, but then, so at first you're helping steer the motorbike out of the way of these mines and things, but then after that, then this big gun turret truck shows up. And what happens is, you're worried about that shooting shooting the bike, but you could just possess the turret and then use that to protect the bike.
Right.
And so that, and of course, at first I was kind of thinking, how would I sort of get over there? But then it's like, when there's a ghost, everything slows down. So it's really easy. There wouldn't be a problem getting over.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the rare cases where for me it kind of all came together. The shooting aspects there, the ghost aspects there. That was probably, I think, the best synthesis of the two parts of the game.
I know that the scripted event set piece thing was still kind of early going at that point in first-person shooters, where now everything since Call of Duty 4 is just a big chain of set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But that game is a game where the whole kind of the set piece combat probably would have worked out nicely, because I think they could have...
You mean in Geist?
Yeah, in Geist. I think they could have contrived scenarios in which you can blend both the action and your abilities better if...
Well, and they do that, just, you know, maybe clumsily at times. But like the part I was talking about earlier with the missile towers and the
guys and the turrets at the bottom. I mean something that's more... It takes you out of just the standard form of going. Like the motorcycle scene is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If they had done more stuff like that in the game, interspersed, these high action, high intensity, brief periods that have a defined length of time, I think that could have been a big benefit to the game.
Yeah, it helped with the pacing a bit, I think, as well.
And it would have, I mean, it would have given them the ability to be creative in how they want to make use of your powers.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next post is from Gojira, who posted, I got Geist from Gamefly today. Initially, I wasn't too impressed. I don't really care for the FPS genre, and I've been playing through the Metroid Prime trilogy, so Geist feels very clunky to me. But once you become a ghost and start doing more of the puzzle stuff, I got into it. That being said, the game kind of reminds me of Mirror's Edge, where I really tried to avoid combat when possible. Maybe the dual analog FPS veterans out there don't have the problems I do, but the game just doesn't jive with my taste, or the control, I should say. Doesn't jive with my taste. There have been some great parts, especially that bit in the beginning where you were being trained in the faux utopian place. So, yeah, I mean, you know, reflecting some other comments we've had, but I definitely agree with Gojira that the utopian stuff at the beginning is awesome.
Yeah, and, it's really cool.
Yeah, and if you like that, I think it's worth playing through, you know, to the chapter where you're a ghost the whole time, because it's similar in some ways to that, although more expansive. And then, again, the second virtual reality simulation, you know, there, it's much more combat-heavy, but some of the elements are still there, I think.
I mean, the one comment I will make about the controls, it's interesting because, you know, I mean, I play a lot of first-person shooters, and I didn't even have a problem. Like I said, I didn't have a problem with the controls with Geist. The one thing I that did occur to me when I started playing, though, is how much I actually liked using the camera stick. Because it's so small, I felt that I had, like, for some reason, it just felt like I had just more control, and it's kind of soft, just the way it's made. Because I haven't used a GameCube controller in ages, and I actually really, really like the GameCube controller. I really like the, for dual analog control, I think it's actually great.
Yeah, it's quite a contrarian position, I suppose, with most people didn't seem, I know Mike didn't like, as he mentioned here, and he certainly did in his review, you know, the C-sticks don't leave something to be desired. I mean, I didn't really have a problem with it, like with time splitters and all that kind of, I got used to it after a while.
Yeah.
But then I didn't have a PS2 pad or an Xbox pad to sort of throw me off, if you like.
Well, you know what it felt like to me? It's like, it felt like kind of, I guess what I would compare it to is when you bowl, and you know how like sometimes if you pick up a really small ball, and you feel like you have so much more control with it. Like you can just throw it around instead of a big honking bowling ball. That's kind of what that felt
yeah.
like.
My problem with the controls has nothing to do with the controller. And it doesn't have any the fact that it's dual analog. Because I've played plenty of games with dual analog. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
To me, it's more the tuning. It's more the responsiveness of moving and aiming.
They could have customized that, but they didn't.
I feel like it feels like my first shooter or something. It's very slow, it's very loose, there's almost no auto aim, so it's actually oddly difficult to like get headshots or to pinpoint on a guy with your gun. Even at close range sometimes it's hard to actually
lot of spray on the guns too.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
Like I am mm-hmm, 5 feet yeah. away from you, but my machine gun has outlined your body perfectly.
Right. Yeah, and that you just would never get away with that in a real first-person
shooter. Which
also
means you will end up getting close in with enemies either, because you can take mm-hmm. quite a lot of that. Your health is quite long, really, you know, relative to the damage that most weapons will do to you. You can pretty much just get up in their face and shoot them.
And you're pretty disposable, yeah. too, I mean...
Yeah, there's that, and there's sometimes. So much health. I mean, there is, even in the deepest parts of the game... there are tell things pretty much all the time that you can find.
Usually.
Yeah, I mean, even in the boss battles themselves and things like that, they're there.
Yeah, well, I think the game would be incredibly frustrating without those health boxes yep. because the aiming is so poor.
I feel that it's possible that they may have, you know, made sure there were plenty of them as a sort of quick fix when they were playtesting it, because, you know, they just felt, you know, this might be actually really quite frustrating if we didn't have it with it. I think as they sort of tone down the shooter element sort of more and more.
Yeah, maybe not in terms of how much of it is in the game, but maybe how difficult and or how technical it is.
Yeah, the skill dependency involved in that.
It's weird. I think actually my favorite shooting, the part in the game where the shooting felt the best was using that sniper rifle, and I think that's the only time in the game where you get to use the sniper rifle.
Yeah.
That's too bad. I thought the sniping actually felt really good, and it's just more of a, it's more of a demonstration. It's kind of, it's like it's teaching you to use the sniper rifle, but then you never actually get to use it in practice.
It's curious, because as you said, so half of that level seems like the climax to a game, but of course the bit before it seems like the tutorial to the game, the yeah. sort of weirdly coming about two-thirds the way through of the actual game.
it's an unusual part of the game, that's for sure. Well, the final forum comment that I pulled out here is a very quick one from Triple X, who posted, Geist is a fun, interesting game that was held back by the substandard production values. It's a bit like Red Steel in that regard. Thoughts?
Oh, I don't want to go into
I've
Red
not
Steel
played Red Steel.
Yeah, I've
Am
played
I the
Red
only
Steel.
One here who's played it? Yeah, I don't want to go into Red Steel comparisons. It's not.
I've only demoed it, but I don't think it's a.
It's not fair to either game to compare them. I would.
Yeah, I don't think they have much in common, really.
I don't think he's implying they have much in common, but Red Steel and this game have different. Their issues stem from a different.
Is it just being rough around the edges in general?
Yeah, I mean they both are, but they're rough in different ways, and the causality is greatly differed. Red Steel, it's not fun. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
It's also made by Ubisoft, right, James?
Yes, it is.
Just I mean, full disclosure.
Red Steel is, as a title, it is technically sound. It's just not fun.
Is it?
Red Steel is actually very low concept. I mean, it's basically, let's combine swords and shooting, except not at the same time, and not do either one of them very
let's
well.
Let's have people randomly pull out swords and say, hey, I've got this gun.
Right.
Fuck it.
And, you know, I think Geist is a very high concept game, and when it delivers on those high concepts, it really works and it feels like something special. Mm-hmm. And I think where Geist falls down is in more of the humdrum stuff, you know, like kind of the filler. I think that's where Geist really doesn't feel that good, is they don't nail the basics. But I kind of wish they wouldn't have even tried. I don't want to play the basics in Geist. That's not what it's about, you know?
So you're right about that, because I think, you know, the experience, like, if it was quicker when you're identifying the items to interact with and the sort of basic action were better and all that sort of stuff, it would just flow much better. And you would like there to be more of the real highlights, but I think the game would still feel substantially better even if the highlights were the same, but the bits in between were just maybe quicker.
Yeah, less painful, less distracting.
Not as irksome and not getting in the way.
Now that we're wrapping up our talk about Geist, maybe we can leave some final thoughts. And I guess my final thoughts would be that even though, you know, obviously we all have some complaints about the game and I have issues with it, I think the brilliant parts of Geist are so brilliant that they absolutely make it worth playing. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very glad that we had this opportunity, this excuse to go catch up on this game, because it was something that, like, when it first came out, I was interested in it for a while, and then it kind of fell off my radar and I never got back around to it. And I'm really glad now that I have, because there are parts in Geist, there are ideas and sequences in there that you're not going to get from any other game that's been made yet. And I'm really glad that I got to play that stuff. And I found it to be really quite thought-provoking and conversation-provoking as well. So I think it was, as it turned out, a pretty good choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, very much intriguing sort of game, really, as much as anything. Mm-hmm. And you can't help but kind of think about applications for some of the concepts in a kind of more suitable sort of forum in the future somehow. But it's still fun to play in itself for a decent amount of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if they announced a sequel coming for Wii, I would be definitely interested in it, that's for sure.
I would be too, absolutely. I'd be totally, regardless of who was developing it. I mean, I would be pretty excited to get another chance with these, you know, with some of these innovative ideas to see what, you know, anybody can do with it. I think it's great. So, James, did you have any final thoughts on Geist before we leave it behind?
I'd hope that we could talk about the multiplayer, but since I guess nobody here's played it.
Yeah. Did you play it?
I didn't. I couldn't convince anyone that, hey, this game with this cover will be fun to play.
You just have impressions.
Trust me.
So I went to the bar the other night and I brought Geist with me. I said, ladies, a little bit of multiplayer with Geist.
I bring
what do
the
you
ladies
say?
Home, John. I bring them home.
I'll be your ghost. I'll be your Geist.
Good Lord.
I didn't have a chance to do any of the actual multiplayer, but like I said, I did get a chance to sort of play it with another person in the main adventure, and I thought that was a pretty cool way to do it, actually. I would say if you haven't finished playing through Geist and you get the opportunity to bring in, you know, maybe a like-minded friend who's interested in how the game's put together and how to solve these puzzles, that's a lot of fun, actually, to have a conversation about it as you're playing through it and to kind of talk out some of these issues. But yeah, I didn't get to play the actual multiplayer mode. And I asked for some thoughts on it from people in the forums, and a couple people chimed in that they'd played it, but they didn't really have anything to say about it. And Mike, you know, Mike Sklins, we asked him about it sort of during the break, and he played it for his review, but he can't remember it at all. So it's obviously not... Nothing all that outstanding. Well, that's going to wrap up our Geist discussion. Thanks to everybody who played along, talked about it in the forums. You know, we hope you enjoyed it. If you haven't been playing along, I hope we've convinced you to check it out at some time, because it's worth doing, I think. Well, now we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with listener mail. Okay, welcome back for listener mail, and Greg has the first letter.
Okay, this is T from Cleveland, writes, I've been listening to the podcast, and you just answered a question about game dreams. My question is probably worse. I played Resident Evil 4 on the GameCube, and then on the Wii, entirely too much. I've seriously completed that game about 15 times between the two systems. I recall taking my son to the sitter a few years back, and the house across the street had a barrel and a flower bed, and I honestly found myself looking at the barrel, wondering if there was treasure or a snake inside, and had to snap myself back to reality. Am I weird, or have any of you shared this experience?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, James, you told me about this, that you rearrange the furniture in your house every day so it feels like it's been randomly generated.
But I don't have enough rooms in my house to substantiate such a fantasy.
Sometimes his bed is right next to the door, so he wakes up in the morning and he's already done.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. He wishes he wakes up right next to the stairwell. So you just leave the level right away.
I think the closest I've had to this experience is like maybe playing a lot of Burnout and then jumping in my car and driving somewhere.
And then wrecking into a tractor trailer to get the big
accident. I've never wrecked because of this, but you feel very velocitized, and you feel like your brain's kind of, you know, you turn a corner or you hit the gas, and it feels like you should be doing it a lot in a more extreme way, you know. But you have to kind of have to check yourself a little bit.
I also had the feeling of wanting to oversteer for watching a lot of TJ Hooker, but that's something else at times.
Oh man!
Yeah, see now that's the thing with Grand Theft Auto 4. That's the thing. Like, you get so used to just walking up to cars and jacking them. I remember being in traffic, and I was just kind of like, I had the urge to just kind of like get out of my car and just walk over. And I'm like, yeah, I like that car. Booyah, get out of there and just grab it and just start driving away with it.
I'm beginning to think that this question was a very insidious plant question from Jack Thompson.
Yes, I don't want to answer this anymore.
With the sole purpose of eliciting the fact that he was right and it makes you do all these stupid things.
Cheers, Jack.
This question's gotta, this question needs to go. It needs to be replaced with, I have never been influenced by video games in any mannerism whatsoever, and conceivably cannot see how anyone could be. The end.
After playing Flower, I wanted to run around and give hugs to people.
There you go.
Despicable.
So, I don't think I've ever had anything quite that intense as T from Cleveland has, but That's a pretty great image of looking at a barrel and wondering if there's a snake in there. That's pretty great, actually.
I hate these snakes.
Yeah. But holy crap, you played Resident Evil 15 times. Yeah. That's pretty that's a long game.
I know people who have played that game like 30 plus times. It blows
Resident
my
Evil
mind.
4?
Yes.
It's like 30 hours long.
I know somebody who has some ridiculous number of just, he's like, yeah, I beat this game like 36 times.
And
I thought he was joking, but then he's like, yeah, you know that section where it's like you take that quick right turn and you turn and there's a guy right there? I hate that part. It gets me every time. I'm like, oh my god, you really have played it that many times.
Imagine if they had actually brought Disaster out to America.
I would have played that game 6,000 times.
You would have wrestled fire tornadoes by now.
Yep.
Burst! James would be looking at wildlife thinking,
yeah, I could take it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You, me, outside, now.
Well, like
Bear,
I said,
I would snap your neck.
My place of work is in the woods, and we do often see deer, and I have often taken them to the ground. I've gone through the plate glass window, landed on its back, and took it out.
All right. James actually has the next letter.
Oh, good. Oni from Florida writes, my question for you is recently, the three console makers, especially Microsoft, have been getting a lot of hate on their practices. Specifically, I've seen a lot of moaning on the absurd pricing scheme of Microsoft's hard drives. What are your thoughts on this? And have there been other instances where gaming companies are trying really hard to bleed their customer for all they're worth in the short run, forsaking the long-run strategy?
Nintendo DSi.
Wii Fit Plus.
Maybe. But I think DSi is worse because it's clearly a stopgap between the DS and the next handheld system. I mean, the DSi is that's not the replacement. It's a modest upgrade at a higher price, and it's clear that they're just kind of testing out some ideas, but they don't really care. That's what I think.
I think also it was at a time where, you know, there's probably going to be some downward pressure on price on the Lite or whatever, but, you know, it's a bit of but what Apple do, so you just bring out a new version and you put a few little extra things in there.
But they didn't drop the price of the Lite.
Because I think it continues to perform so well. I mean, it's a lot of it. If it hadn't so much, maybe they might have phased a bit differently, but clearly it's doing well because it is arguably better value if you don't care about the digital distribution.
Well,
stuff.
The DSi looks better too. I mean, the screen does at least.
Yeah.
The screens are bigger. The buttons feel a little better, maybe. They're little things, but yeah. I mean, I could see that. But I mean, I guess what with Microsoft, was he talking about the wireless adapter?
Well, the wireless adapter is a sham. Yeah.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. But here's the deal. I mean, the wireless adapter, there are third-party alternatives.
There are,
but aren't as expensive.
With a hard drive, you can only use a Microsoft hard drive.
Right.
There's some pretty intensive hacking to get any other hard drive working
and
on an Xbox 360.
It's not worth it.
I mean, no.
Which is different from the PS3, isn't it?
Yeah, the PS3 is designed to easily replace hard drives. The ones that we have, Greg, have 160 gigs. I don't anticipate needing more than that.
No, definitely not me. I won't need to change
I swap mine, my original 60 gig with a 300 gig.
Yeah. It's nice that you can, and it's not proprietary. I mean, yep. I guess that's the point. Yeah, I mean, I guess there's always been gouging, especially where someone's had market power, which I wouldn't so much say you could with Microsoft. That's kind of a bit weird, but
I've got one example that is even more topical than the DSi, the PSP Go.
Oh yeah, that's
that one is on multiple levels.
It's just kind of perplexing.
Yeah,
I don't think Sony's really bleeding customers. I think they are experimenting.
That's the whole thing. I mean, it seems that Sony will push their, I guess, agenda at any cost.
What's that? You already own this game? Well, too bad.
Yeah, it's like, oh, well, we want people to take to accept Blu-ray. So, well, the only alternative that we have is to put Blu-ray in our console and make a $600. Oh, well.
Oh, and delay it 6 months because they couldn't produce the diodes.
Yeah, it's... I don't know,
The weird thing about the Go is that it's clearly designed to appeal to people who have not previously owned PSPs.
Yeah.
You know, which would be like me. I've never owned a PSP. I wouldn't mind having one. You know, I mean, the price has been a major factor among other technical limitations like battery life and... the Go doesn't address any of those problems.
No.
It's like they've made a product for me without actually listening to what I want.
That's the thing, you know? I mean, the PSP Go might prick your sort of ears and interest in it, but then you might look at the other SKUs that have the UMD drive and just say, well, they're better value.
Because they are better value. I mean, but in every conceivable
form. They're too
form.
Big. I'm not interested in owning anything on UMD.
Yeah.
And the battery life is shorter because there is a freaking disk drive in it, like you know, all these, and you know, the games are more expensive because they're on disk. Like these are things that the Go should have solved, and yet Sony went out of their way to not actually solve them.
Well, the thing is, like, I just bought Arctic Edge. I got that game for on sale at Amazon for $31. If I buy it off of PSN, it's $40.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
And it just came back to me.
Because the thing is, if they put new games on the download shop for a significant discount from the retailers,
people might actually buy them.
Exactly, we'd be all out war on the retailers, though. But that's how
it already is. It already is all out war. The retailers are all competing against each other. Why can't they compete against Sony too?
But are they really? And we've discussed this. Are they really competing against each other? The prices of games are set by the publishers. I mean, they really are. Nobody really undercuts that MSRP. It all just sort of hangs around there. I mean, you're not going to find a new game on sale.
Well, John just got Arctic Edge on sale. It's a new game.
That's really quite new, yeah.
I'll call that the Amazon exception, though.
I mean, yeah. I'll call it the
Amazon
Mamba
does tend to do that.
Yeah, but I mean, like, retail, you're not going to find that. It's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is really all-out war on the secondhand games market.
Oh, yeah, sure, that's a big part of that. But you know what I mean? It's just like, if it's a case of every new release is going to be 75% of the cost that it is at retail, then retail might start, you know, retaliating more than they have been with the idea of the Go.
They'll just not sell the Go at their stores.
They seem to be sort of tolerating it.
Yeah, fuck you, Sony. We're just not going to sell it.
Kind of expecting it to fail.
That's the thing. I mean, I know in the UK they're already selling it at 200 or whatever. Like, they've already taken off a huge discount.
It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. Oh, yeah. I mean, £25 shy of the PS3 price. That is crazy.
It should be cheaper than the PSP 3000. It has fewer parts. It's smaller. The screens are smaller. The battery life is actually less because it lasts for the same, even though there's no physical drive in it. It is less hardware than the PSP 3000. It should cost less.
Yeah.
It has less functionality. It should cost less, not nearly twice as much.
Because that's what with the PS3, I mean, they've done that. You know, the new version coincided with a price drop because, yes, mm-hmm. we've rationalized the production of the thing and it's cheaper to make. And it's like, well, why didn't that happen with the handheld then, if that's so attainable?
Yeah, I mean, at least with the DSi, they did actually add features that you can only get on the DSi.
Yeah.
I still don't think it's worth it, but that's subjective. I mean, with a PSP, there's no fucking way it's worth it.
No, it's not.
It's completely illogical.
There's no exclusive content, really, is there? Because you've got the memory stick that you can use on your old PSP, so all of this stuff, whether it's the PSP minis or it's the new games on the PlayStation Network, you could get all of it on your usual PSP.
Yeah, I mean, like I was looking, I was saying this to Luke, I was saying, like, right now on Amazon, you can get the Gran Turismo PSP package for $200, and then you can buy like a SanDisk Pro Duo Stick, a 16 gig one, which is exactly the same as what's in the PSP Go. You can buy that for like, I think, $65,
which is a lot of money for a storage device.
It's a lot of money, but that's $265.
Because going back to what we said earlier, because Sony pushing their format on everybody.
Yeah.
You will use our memory stick, even
and
though
by
no
the way,
one uses it, and it costs a fortune to make.
You can probably get a better price than the SanDisk.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That just happened to be the cheapest one on there. I mean, the thing is, like, but like for $15 over the PSP Go, you can get a free game. And you can also use all of your old UMDs. You know what I mean?
Or you can buy used UMDs.
Yeah. Yeah,
see,
exactly.
The whole,
it's
look,
ridiculous.
I mean, the whole UMD incompatibility thing doesn't matter to me. I don't own any UMDs. I don't care. It's everything else that's wrong with the Go that bothers me.
But it would
me.
Still be like Nintendo releasing a DSi and they've changed what a DSi cart looks like. Like,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't fit in there anymore. It's like, what do you mean they don't fit in there anymore?
Yeah, but DSi at least has exclusive content. I mean, it's not a big, massive exclusive content at this point. It's debatable how much it'll grow in the future at this point. It may be more significant, it may not, but it's there. You haven't got that with the PSP.
Right. If the DSi becomes popular, it will grow. it will become, it mm-hmm. will reach that mass.
Well, they said they've sold more than 2 million in the US since
that's,
it came
that's,
out, apparently.
That's a strong indicator we're going to see more and more exclusive content for it.
Well, I'll tell you this, I think we'll see the next Nintendo DS before we see the next Wii.
Well, we should.
And I think it'll get announced, I think it'll at least get announced next year, if not released. Well, we need to move on. The next question is from Pixelated Pixies in Belfast, Ireland, who writes that Nintendo has always been known for bringing back its classic franchises, which is fine if they also innovate. Their approach of late, however, seems to be, for lack of a better word, lazy. New Super Mario Bros. Wii, Wii Fit Plus, Metroid Prime Trilogy, Zelda Spirit Tracks, these are all great games, but ones that fail to deliver any new experiences. Do you think Nintendo have become complacent?
Yeah, I think some of the problem with this is, you know, when people get worried about the casual inclined stuff, you know, I guess the implicit thing in that is that there's a rivalry between developing those games and developing other games. And I think perhaps where that, if that exists, has been felt is not so much in getting the franchise games going because they're so bankable, they've kept doing it. But what it probably has meant is that that's their new IPs, that's their sort of more adventurous stuff, and that isn't targeted so much at traditional gamers. So the sort of the new Nintendo stuff, kind of like, you know, a sort of a new Pikmin, not literally a new game in the Pikmin series, but a new series like Pikmin that would appeal to traditional gamers, but it's completely different, it's original, you know, and not a spin-off of an existing franchise. Those sorts of things may be being stifled by the amount of attention that they're giving to Wii Fit and Wii Sports Resort and so forth.
I'm about to get slammed, but I don't care. I really enjoyed Phantom Hourglass. I thought it was an extremely, extremely good title.
So no, I liked it.
I liked it. I don't know if I want another one.
Yeah. I do.
I see some of Phantom Hourglass' shortcomings as an opportunity that this one could be really, really good.
Yeah.
Seriously excellent, but obviously it's hard to say whether they will actually completely take that opportunity or not. But
and I'm happy just to get another Zelda game because I had maybe 20 hours of really solid fun playing Phantom Hourglass. I'd be more than happy to repeat that experience with just new levels. I mean, it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's not earth shattering, but you know, you feel pretty confident that it's gonna deliver something, you know, that you will enjoy.
I don't think Phantom Hourglass gets enough credit. I mean, I look at that game as being the handheld Zelda 64. I mean, it really took the handheld Zelda. I'm serious. It took the handheld Zelda games and changed everything about them. Like Zelda 64 changed the console Zelda games and changed everything about them.
Yeah. Okay. But Ocarina of Time, there was nothing like that ever before.
Okay.
Whereas Phantom Hourglass is in many ways derivative of Wind Waker. It is based on Wind Waker.
Well, yeah,
in many ways, and it does some things differently, and I totally give it credit for that. Now, you know, some of them work better than others.
Give me more of the control scheme, James.
Yeah, just in how the game plays. I mean, there are some things that we've seen in Spirit Tracks already that look kind of interesting, like the fact that you can control your big scary statue of death all day.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things I'm quite happy to have. I guess the point that he's making here is that, you know, you've got these games. The new Super Mario Bros. Wii would fit very much into the same category, I think, apart from the multiplayer aspect, which you can't dismiss because that's huge. But
that is the game. I mean, really.
I don't think it's entirely the game, but, you know, I think obviously that's a massive, massive part. But kind of look at it as a single player for now. Again, for me, I'm looking at that thinking, I don't know if I'm mega, mega excited about it. Some of the things I've been hearing lately about the fact that, you know, they're kind of using this demo play feature to make the game harder, essentially.
Yeah,
that excites me, frankly.
Which is almost backwards of what you would expect from the demo.
We talked about it on the show. We said the upside of this, when they had the pattern, we talked about this. We said the upside is that you could actually say, we don't have to water it down, because if it's that frustrating, they could just skip it. So,
mm-hmm. That
was always the upside, but didn't mean they were necessarily going to take that approach, but the early impressions are that they are. So I do find that exciting. But in general, what you're looking at with that game is, it's going to deliver something that I'll enjoy because you know what it is. And that's something. So you kind of like that as a sort of staple diet of your gaming, but you also want new experiences that are going to kind of, you know, do something that you haven't seen before, because it does it all entertain you in a different way when it's fresh like that. And yeah. So I think what you might like to see is just more complementary. You know, when you've got Spirit Tracks and New Super Mario Bros. Wii together in a holiday season, they don't complement each other that well from the point of view that they kind of, you know, they're both this kind of reliable entertainment rather than, you know, the sort of fresh kind.
And there are other opportunities out there not being published by Nintendo this year to do that. And I wonder.
Oh yeah, sure.
I think it's definitely been an off year for Nintendo in terms of innovation.
I think it's been an off 2 years.
There was a lot last year, I felt like. I felt like last year was good for Nintendo. The holiday season was maybe a little dry.
Yeah.
But overall, I felt like Nintendo kind of pushed into some areas, especially with Wii Fit.
Well, yeah, it's a big deal.
Crazy.
And I mean, obviously,
shit.
you've had Sports Resort this year, which it depends whether you want to call that innovation or whether you want to call it more about the efficacy, you know, about the fact that they've just taken this step before and now we're kind of delivering on the vision that we had before.
Yeah.
But the applications for Motion Plus in the future in a Zelda game or in completely new IP, you know, which would be even more so, they could be more of an innovation. You know, they could be more like real new gameplay experiences.
Yeah.
And I really hope we're going to get that next year.
But I do feel like at E3 this year, with all the game announcements Nintendo made, most of them did feel like they were kind of lacking in fresh ideas. And the two exceptions being, hopefully, Metroid Other M and the new Zelda, both of which were spoken about in very vague, mysterious terms.
Well, the thing is, what I find now is that, I mean, the more adventurous stuff coming from Nintendo is not actually being made by Nintendo themselves, which I find really interesting. Like, a lot of the big upcoming games, like Other M, it's not made by them.
Well, it is partially made by them, to be fair. It's not just Team Ninja.
It's just interesting that a lot of, like, Nintendo's internal teams, what the hell are they doing?
Well, they have been doing a lot of Wii Sports Resort, Wii Fit. I mean, they have been doing a lot of that. I mean, that's true.
Animal
but they
Crossing.
I think they're also doing other things. And
that we don't know about, really.
That's what everybody says, but I mean...
Well, they're not just sitting around drinking coffee all day,
I know,
day, John.
But I mean, you know, like, that's the thing. I mean, that's what everybody says. Oh, well, they're working on magical, mystical stuff. Okay, well, then why don't they say something about it? I mean, these are teams that have literally not said anything for like 3 or 4 years.
I think you're overstating that, John. I think you're overstating
Depends
that,
on the team, but I mean, like, for example, aside from Metroid Prime Trilogy, what the heck has Retro been doing?
Big Under the Dark. I mean, they are on the cusp of an explosion of something.
One would think, certainly. Like, there's an inevitable part that they are, you know, some of their development resources are going to make Wii Fit and Wii Sports Resort and all that, and for some people...
And that's fine.
For some people, that doesn't count, which, you know, I don't look at it that way, but
I don't
apparently
that way
other
either.
People
It counts
do.
For Nintendo.
You're big time, jeez, it really counts for Nintendo.
Yeah, it counts for Nintendo in dollar signs.
They're chasing the money at the end of the day, and that's their job, that's what they do.
Yeah, and that's the point, the franchise stuff for the traditional market or the traditional Nintendo market is bankable, right?
Yeah.
And then on the other side, the more adventurous stuff is kind of maybe a little riskier in some ways, but also with the install base at this point, the power of the marketing, that's pretty bankable too.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's where they... And then the middle of the road stuff that you might consider that, you know, like I said, like an equivalent of a Pikmin now, is not yet apparent, which is a shame because you do like to see that kind of new stuff. But as has been made before, I mean, there haven't been that many of those sorts of things in Nintendo's whole history.
No,
it's not just now.
I mean, Pikmin was an outlier.
Yeah, one thing that we're dancing around a little bit here is to get back to the question. I mean, what we're, I think, agreeing on to some extent is that Nintendo is becoming complacent.
They're conservative,
to the extent
I think,
that
they
feel like they know what will sell. And
yeah.
Some of it is traditional stuff. Some of it is more blue ocean, whatever. But they're not pushing the boundaries that much in terms of really blowing your mind or surprising you. And they're the market leader, so really we shouldn't be all that surprised by it. If you look at the platform holder that's doing the most experimental, exotic, strange stuff that you're like, why would anybody buy that? I would say this generation it's been Sony, because they're coming from a place of weakness where maybe they feel like they have nothing to lose, or
they have to get
people's attention by doing the craziest stuff. And look at some of the games they've published this generation. They did Nobi Nobi Boy. I mean, there's really Sony, and there's a lot of examples. I'm not saying all of these are good games, but, you know, and they certainly didn't do any of that during the PS2 days, did they?
Well, I mean, no, seriously, though, Sony does stuff where you're just like, this stuff is neat from an experimental standpoint, but who the hell is going to buy it? Eye of Judgment? Seriously, that sold like probably, I mean, I think I was one of the five people in the country that bought that game.
I'll still make fun of you for it.
Yeah. I mean, I think Nintendo is a bit complacent, and I think they have a right to be. I'm not necessarily happy about it, but I think they're in the proper position to be that way. And eventually it may come around to push them down the totem pole a little bit, and they might have to fight. I mean, look, when Wii was first announced, no one would say Nintendo's being complacent. People said they were out of their minds.
Yeah, they're batshit crazy.
But look, at the time, Nintendo was in third place. They had to do something to grab your attention. That's the way the world works. You know?
I still think they were out of their minds, but you can be crazy and be genius. I think.
Well, the thing is, though, they had the software to back it up, though, right?
Yeah,
sure.
One of the sort of upsides I always saw of this choice to go with the sort of basically last gen technology with the graphics hardware and everything, it's like, okay, well, the development costs are going to be lower, and the cycles can be somewhat quicker perhaps than they've been in the past, because you're not having to adapt to a whole lot of new hardware that's going to tack on to each development process more time. So it's like, well, maybe we'll get a greater volume of output, and maybe they'll be willing to take more risks, because
it hasn't really borne out.
The relative investment, the initial investment is relatively smaller, but no, it hasn't really borne out yet, and that does disappoint me somewhat. But I'm hopeful that perhaps, once, especially, I think Motion Plus has some potential to, to open up their creative juices a bit if they want to. So if the install base of Motion Plus gets big enough and they have some success with certain games on it, and that could be one way that they'll get the ball rolling a bit.
I'm starting to get concerned about Motion Plus. It's gone dark, a little too dark for me, for a product that's already on the market.
There's nothing from Nintendo concretely on the horizon.
There's not really anything from third parties except Red Steel 2. That's it. That is it right now.
It is odd. I mean, you would think that they might have had something this holiday season of some sort. Not necessarily something as big as Zelda, because
maybe they were
commitment.
Just counting on Red Steel 2 doing it for them. You would have
thought they might have taken it into their own hands to say, look, Motion Plus is this entity that we're invested in, and we want to sustain momentum. We don't want to leave that to chance. We're going to have Wii Sports Resort, going to get the ball rolling. Obviously, it's going to be massive. And then we'll have something else to sustain the momentum.
Maybe they're going to plan another media blitz for the holiday season on Wii Sports Resort and use that.
Oh, yeah,
Maybe they just feel like it's got enough legs that it can
Tiger did well with the Motion Plus bundle and stuff relatively, and also, I mean, it's not all about Wii Sports Resort, but you still might have thought they might have been a little more proactive about saying, well, this Wii Motion Plus is not something that you just play Wii Sports Resort with. It's not like the balance board, even though obviously you can play other games with the balance board.
I think that's a good example of where Nintendo took just a mass... I mean, they bundled a $90 scale with the game and said, congratulations, you now have balance board.
Well, next year is the vitality sensor.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's what you have to look forward to.
John's going to attach the vitality sensor to his center of vitality.
Oh, no.
Oh, I'm not even going to touch that.
Speaking of John, it's time for the
next
final
question.
Letter.
All right. Yes. Anton writes, recently it seems as if Japanese devs are making games for the Wii that you cannot find anywhere else, like Little King Story and Muramasa come to mind. I personally enjoyed this load of games we are getting from the Land of the Rising Sun. However, will there be a time when all of this runs out? The two games I mentioned above are some of the best games I've played this year, and to be honest, Little King Story is my favorite game this whole generation. What do you guys think about the Japanese games on the Wii? Do you think they are reaching their sales potential? Do you think there is a fear of them disappearing from localization? I would also like to give a shout-out for one of my favorite games ever made, Killer 7. This is a game that most people overlooked on the GameCube. I think Suda51 was sad when the Wii was announced, because Killer 7 would have been an even better game with the IR aiming than it ended up being. Still, this game had the best story from any game I've ever seen. P.S. I also dislike the Beatles. Yes!
Ooh, now I have two reasons to disagree with Anton.
I think this must be one of our relatively newer listeners when I say that. Probably wasn't listening to 2 years ago, but because the podcast was pretty much just a shout out to Killer 7 for all the time from when the first pirate radio started to when Carl left.
Our former host and editor, Carl Castaneda, is a big fanboy for Killer 7.
Evangelist, I would say.
Yeah. I have played Killer 7 enough to know that I hate it. Absolutely hate it. I hated it at E3. I rented it not long after it came out. Hated it then. Could barely stand to play it for more than like 30 minutes. And then someone last year, I think it might have been Neil. I can't remember exactly who it was. I apologize to that person. But someone let me borrow it. They mailed it to me because I was like, Carl keeps talking about it. You know, Carl said he was going to let me borrow it. And he never did. For this went on for like a year. Yeah.
Every time he was about to put it in the envelope, he was like Bilbo with the ring. It was like, no, can't do it. It's suddenly getting very heavy, disc. I can't do it.
The disc was actually on his finger.
Yeah.
So on a necklace, right?
Oh, my precious.
Someone finally let me borrow it, and I put it in, and I went in really with an honest and a fresh mind. I said, I want to try to like this game, you know? Whatever I thought about it before, it doesn't matter. I want to get into this, because people kept telling me that they love it. There has to be something to it. I open up, it's two discs. What the fuck?
Oh, God.
I put one in, and like, seriously, within 30 minutes, I'm so done with this game. Maybe it has a terrible beginning, but I could not get through it. I ended up playing it for a little over an hour, and just couldn't stand it. Yeah, I thought it was absolutely
I've always
atrocious.
Been intrigued for some of the same reasons. Obviously, I did listen to the podcast for that time when it was a big love letter to Killer 7 and plenty of other people have written complimentary things about it. So I was always intrigued, but I've never gone over the edge, because what I have read, even for the people that do like it, is that basically, you know, the gameplay is not really the point. And for me, that's a turn-off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I enjoyed the game well enough, and I think sometimes it gets... I wouldn't say the gameplay is not the point. I would say the gameplay is a mechanism by which he imparted the experience, and that experience is F the hell up.
Yeah, so it's a weird sort of medium for it. I mean, it's a shooting gallery, the sort of on rails, but not quite. Like,
exactly.
You've got limited control over your movement. And obviously, it's on the GameCube, so you're using the analog stick to do all of this. As he says, it seems like it'd be much better suited to Wii.
Yeah, but I think Suda would fuck it up on Wii too. Because I think that's on purpose. I mean, look, the controls in Killer 7 are intentionally bad.
All right, you have to point the Wii remote at your stomach the whole time you're playing it.
I think the controls in Killer 7 are intentionally bad, and I just cannot abide that. It's some kind of artistic expression of the creator. Fine, I can't play it.
Oh, I mean, come on, this is a guy who made a game called Michigan about murders. I mean, this is a weird dude. This guy
is definitely weird.
It's kind of ironic considering sort of Travis Touchdown is all about escapism. That you make a game called Michigan.
Well, and he made Flower, what was it, Flower, Sun, and Rain? Nick basically told me, if you buy this game, you're an idiot.
Yeah, I guess we should get back to the other part of the question about the Japanese games. So it mentions Little King Story and Muramasa about the Japanese games, which are both marvelous games in Japan, as we mentioned when we was talking to Matt last week. And, you know, they haven't been doing that well all you hear is Marvelous talking about putting them on other systems and stuff. So
I think both of those games were probably designed with extensibility to other platforms in mind.
Well, certainly we talked about Little King Story sort of having the almost sort of bemusing lack of point of integration.
It makes no sense.
Sure, and there's none in Muramasa either, and there shouldn't be. But it would be quite easy to port Muramasa to another system.
So, I mean, you do worry about, you know, certainly in the native market, you know, a lot of these, because, you know, I mean, it's such a different picture in Japan where Wii is just so far and away the dominant console so far. Obviously, the week-to-week sales are changing pretty drastically with the PS3 price cut, and then the Wii price cut, I think, has just happened in Japan, so it's all over the place right now. But hitherto, you know, it's just this ridiculous domination of Wii. PS3 hasn't done very well. 360's, you know, borderline relevant. But in terms of third-party success with games, like, so you haven't got, you know, these games that monopolize the chart that are in America, in Japan, the same ones. You know, they're completely different. But at the same time, it's still been a struggle for third-party Japanese games to sell very well in many cases. Obviously, Monster Hunter has done well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but yeah, that's a very, very special case with a dedicated fan base.
Yeah, really, the case is that Japanese games aren't a whole lot more popular in Japan than they are in America.
Well, especially console games. Portable, you know, seems to be doing relatively well in Japan. It just seems there's a pretty big shift, you know, decisive shift away from console gaming in Japan. And, you know, that obviously will affect us over here, because, you know, it's going to affect the Japanese developers, if you like, Japanese developed games most acutely.
I never believed that no matter how good those two games were and how much hype they got, that they would do well, at least in the U.S., in part because they're not genres that tend to do well. I mean...
Mm-hmm.
Even regardless of where their origin is, they're just not
mainstream.
Yeah,
sort
I mean,
of mass market.
It's, I mean, one of these games is based on Pikmin, which, as we know, was a mainstream success in all marketing and
almost despite itself, I'd say. But yeah, it was.
I mean, let's be honest. It wasn't a major title, even though it had Nintendo behind it. It wasn't, you know, a world beater.
No, it was an average success.
Yeah,
it
was successful.
So. Is it surprising that a similar game without Nintendo's backing didn't do as well?
No. And look, I wouldn't be that concerned about it. I mean, if there are people to buy these games, they will buy these games. I guarantee that companies like XSEED and Atlus and Natsume...
Well, until XSEED goes out of business.
Well, all these boutique publishers, I mean, honestly, James, they thrive on making you think that they're about to go out of business. Because they
yeah, because you got to go out and get it, yeah. Yeah, you gotta go out and get it to save the marketplace, essentially.
Yeah, these boutique publishers build up a fan base who will buy almost anything that they publish, regardless of what it is. And they make you think that, well, you know, we just brought this crazy Japanese game over here. If you guys don't buy it, we won't be able to keep bringing over these crazy Japanese games. And Atlus has run for 10 years on that principle, and people fall for it. It's like Atlus at this point is bringing out 2-3 games a month. They're making a killing.
Well, mm-hmm. What I find funny is that now we've got a situation where we have the Atlus XSEED kind of showdown now between these games. I really wonder if that's going to be good. I mean, this might not be healthy for either of these companies.
Atlus is mostly doing portable stuff these days.
Yeah. But mm-hmm. It's funny though, because 2 years ago, I never heard of XSEED. But by the end of this year, they're going to have a frightening number of titles I own that are XSEED titles. I mean, just ridiculous.
Well, they're bringing over games that you're interested in.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I'm sure that the number of copies they're selling in America are usually in line with their expectations and are in line with the cost for them to localize it and publish it here. These games, again, were not that popular in Japan, so they're probably getting the publishing rights for a pretty good deal.
I think the concern would be, you know, we'd go back to the sort of wording of Anton's question, is not so much that they would disappear from localization, is that they would disappear at the source.
Yeah.
You probably should be concerned about that.
That's the issue, is that, you know, with the state of the console market in Japan, you know, with the Japanese developers, the way their attitudes are perhaps changing with the shift to portables, that's where I'd be concerned that they're not going to, you know, that they may look at third-party sales in North America as sort of the last hope of profitability. And then the third party titles, you know, for any system that tend to sell best in the American markets are for the HD consoles in the main part.
What's the thing? I mean, you're seeing that now with Japanese companies kind of trying to
westernize a little
bit.
Yeah,
they're trying to westernize. I mean,
isn't Tecmo making a Gears of War knockoff and
yeah.
All this kind of
Tits
stuff?
Tits of War.
And Lost Planet is very much that.
Yeah, it very much is.
So I think already we're seeing the movement of traditional Japanese-style games, like, you know, the ones Anton apparently really likes to play. They're starting to gravitate towards the platforms that are cheaper to develop for, namely Wii and DS and PSP. Mm-hmm. And I think they're going to find a stable home on those platforms because, you know, they're not going to be the grandest productions you've ever seen anymore.
Yeah.
But they'll survive there. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, just like we've seen 2D games, years and years and years, people said 2D games are dead, can't believe we're not going to have our 2D platformers anymore. And look, today, we still got tons of 2D platformers. They're mostly on DS, and they're really good. Or, in some cases, they're on digital platforms, where you don't have all the distribution costs.
Well, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? Because at this point, you know, you kind of may be stuck in between a rock and a hard place with some of these games, in the sense that, you know, maybe in principle they might, you know, because of the way the Wii sort of environment is, it was difficult to sell a lot of copies on Wii for third-party games because it's so sort of dominated by Nintendo and things like that. But on the other hand, on the other formats, the development costs are a lot higher, so you've got to sell a lot more copies to actually cover it in the first place.
Yeah, much riskier.
It's tough either way, but yeah, I kind of think they will probably just, you know, certainly portable for absolutely sure, because obviously they're much, much more healthy in Japan in the first place. But probably we, you know, even though it's not, it doesn't seem like the snuggest fit, so will probably be their main focus of operation for consoles for the time being. Yeah.
If there's a market for these kinds of games, someone will fill it at some point.
And at some cost.
At some cost.
You'll have to balance out correctly, but you'll find some sort of equilibrium there.
You know, if it comes to the point where Japanese developers no longer want to make the traditional old-school Japanese kinds of games, eventually you'll find that Western companies start doing it. Look at Shadow Complex. They said, there aren't enough good 2D Metroid games, so we're going to make our own, and they did a damn fine job of it. And there are actually a lot of other examples of that if you dig around. So if you like a particular kind of game and there are at least a few thousand other people like you, that game is going to show up. You might have to wait a little longer between releases or whatever. You might have to, you might not get it on the platform of your choice, but it's going to happen. So it's going to be all right. Don't worry. You're going to be okay. All right. Well, that is the that's the end of this show. So thanks to everybody who wrote in. Of course, you can get your letter into the crew and maybe read on the show by sending that to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We love these thought-provoking questions, and we like to talk. It's good to have varied topics to do that. So thank you to everyone, and please keep sending in those great letters. Yeah. Go to the polls, go to the forums, and vote for your favorite Genesis game for the next Retroactive. We'll be doing that soon. And I also want to say that TYP and I recorded an episode of Radio Trivia, which will probably be going live around the time that this episode does. So if you like the Radio Trivia thing, go check that out. I think we had a pretty nice lineup of games. So that's all. Thanks to Mike Sklins for stopping in for a little guys chat. We'll have him back at some point. And thanks to Greg, John, and James for being awesome every single week.
Cool. Later.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I think the first thing that came out of the discussion that you guys had with Jeff that I found quite interesting was an issue that John brought up.
What the fuck is that?
Sorry, that's my dogs.
Those are dogs? Really?
I'm not going to regret not having to cut that out of all three segments, I'll be honest.
James, do you find yourself shooting off at weather patterns?
Low pressure system, this bitch!
All right. Enough of that. So, James actually has the next letter.
Oh, good. Perfect.
Oh, God.
Oh, all right. Give me a second.
I'm just, God. Silly me trying to bring goodwill into this discussion.
How is it goodwill? Oh, here's a game you can't play.
John,
suck
you're so
up,
much
bitch.
Better than the rest of us.
I'm a dreamer, Johnny. Really? What can I say?
I want to be like you when I grow up.
No, you don't.